Good evening. Please grab seats. Wonderful to see everybody here. We're going to have a panel tonight to talk a bit about NATO and the European Union. And I hope, as always, that this will be a panel that can move across the political, the diplomatic, the military, and we certainly are well positioned to do that with this particular group of panelists. At my extreme right, my very good friend, Ambassador Rose Gottmiller, known to, I suspect, everybody here as the Deputy Secretary General of NATO, former arms control specialist, Ambassador of the United States in an earlier incarnation. Welcome, Rose. We then have two ministers of defense, not one, but two. Frank Bakke-Jensen, Minister of Defense of Norway, and my friend from NATO days, Yuri Luik, Minister of Defense of Estonia. I think these are excellent suggestions for ministers to put on this panel, given the geopolitical positioning of these two nations and how they interrelate both in the EU, not EU, etc. And then to represent the European Union, if I may, we have the Chief Executive of the European Defense Agency, Jorge Domecq of Spain. Great to have you here as well, Mr. Director. And on my immediate right, if I may say so, a great friend of mine, someone who was a mentor to me in my days as a uniformed officer, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina of the United States, one of the leading defense experts and, of course, a leading voice in Washington on all defense issues and on the Senate Armed Services Committee. So we put together a terrific panel tonight, and the format will be as follows. I'll ask each of our interlocutors to say a word or two, kind of in the 5-minute range, about their views on NATO, European Union. Are there challenges and opportunities here, as well as the defense environment that we see today? After each of them speaks for 5 minutes or so, I'll ask a couple of questions to kind of kickstart the conversation. And then we'll, as always, as our founder and as Wolfgang Ischinger loves to prod us toward, this becomes a conversation for this room of real experts. We are all peers together in this conversation. With that, let me ask the Deputy Secretary General, Ambassador Gottmiller, to lead off. Rose.
Thank you very much, Jim. And I think you've got a great title for this panel to follow up on what we just heard this afternoon, including from Secretary General Stoltenberg just a few moments ago. So I'd like to pick up on the name of the panel and riff on it a bit, if I may. It is EU and NATO, defense cooperation, European, capable, connected, with a question mark at the end. I'm going to answer that question, yes, so I'll give you that right up front, but I want to say a few words about why. First of all, European and capable. This is not the first time this week I appeared on the podium with my colleague, the Minister of Defense of Norway, and also with Jorge Domecq, who is the head of the European Defense Agency. In Brussels this week, we had a signing ceremony during the defense ministerial for the new multi-role tanker and transport aircraft. This is a big deal because it brings together already, and this is the point I wanted to stress, it already brings together NATO and the EU bending metal, putting together new defense capabilities. And so people ask, you know, can this happen? Can you do this? Can you cooperate? The answer is yes. We are already doing it. And it's not only Norway that's a partner in this. We just welcomed Belgium this week, and there are three other NATO countries involved as well. So I wanted to say the first two parts of the question are already answered. European and capable, the answer is yes, and we're already out there bending metal. So I think that's an important thing. Next point I wanted to turn to in talking to my old friend Yuri Luik is to say connected. Connected, yes, and that's thanks to Estonia, who from the very beginning, in our tussle with what to do about the new world of cyber war and cyber conflict has helped us to understand just how serious it can be with the attack they took on a national basis in 2007. And since, they have helped us through the Center of Excellence in Tallinn to really figure out this problem and to really press ahead and to make things happen inside NATO. So connected, yes. And then the last thing I wanted to say has to do with one I wanted to add, and that is transatlantic. Again, Jens Stoltenberg talked about that a lot in the last session, but we feel that there is a strong inherent bond that has been questioned over time, but really shouldn't be questioned over time because it is always reinstating and reproving itself. And I wanted to say thank you to Senator Lindsey Graham because last June he put together a very strong resolution in the U.S. Congress that was passed unanimously backing up support for the NATO alliance on a transatlantic basis. So I like the title of this panel very, very much, but I would add not only capable, European, and connected, but you got to have the transatlantic in there too. So, Jim, I'll leave it at that.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Mr. Minister.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for the possibility to discuss this topic here in Munich. I'm raised and born in Norway, Finnmark, 70 degrees north, 100 kilometers from the Russian border. When I was 25 years old, served in the army, the Soviet Union was something dark, dangerous, unknown behind the border. I have a daughter who's 30 years younger than me. For Hanna, Russia is the most exciting neighbor country. She knows, she has students her age with people, with parents from Russia. She sees it differently. The difference between me and Hanna is that Hanna, from she was born, knew that on both sides of a border there lives people like us. I needed to learn that when I was grown up, grew up. And this learning, Hanna could thank two great institutions for the development in Europe. It's EU and it's NATO. Because we know, without these two institutions, we wouldn't have this this development. So, when the answer is today, could we cooperate? When the question is, could we cooperate? The answer is yes, we need to. Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, and Iceland are the five Nordic countries. We have for decades cooperated. We have Denmark, which is a member both of NATO and EU. We have Sweden and Finland, which is a member of EU, but have not had the possibility to go into the alliance of historical reasons and geographical reasons and cultural reasons. Then we have Norway and Iceland, which is a part members of NATO. Despite this, we have been able to create one of the best regional cooperation system and one of the most integrated regions in the world, in the Nordic. And I think we could get some examples from that cooperation also when we're discussing EU and NATO. Because the Nordic countries is better when we cooperate with the Baltic countries. The Nordefco is even better in the Northern Group context. Mm-hmm. And we are really good when we can meet in the EU-NATO context. So cooperating the planes is one thing. I think we will see in Europe and in the NATO-EU context, a lot of this form of cooperation. We're building good models. This is a way for some of the countries to participate. And the crisis we will see in the future are different from the crisis we had in the past. Because it will the border between a civil crisis and a military crisis will be blurred. We will have problems with telling when does this start, mm-hmm. Where will it end. We need to build defense forces, but we will also need to build more diplomacy, more economic aid, and more communication technologies, be good at that. So I think the next step we have to take in Europe and in the Western world is to cooperate as good as possible between EU and NATO. It won't be easy, but we need to be clear on what's the role of NATO and what's the role of EU, and then in some part of the future we need to accept that whether you're a member of both organizations or only one, you need to participate equal to create peace. I think that's the main goal we need to set. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Frank. Mr. Minister.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you for inviting me to this conference and to this very important panel. Now, Estonia had the EU presidency till December last year. And during our presidency, some of the key components of the new European defense architecture were created, like PESCO or like the European Defense Fund. But to be honest, we would have never worked with those projects if we would have believed that they would in any way step over NATO or kind of copy what NATO is doing. I think the debate, if there ever was debate about what NATO's role is, ended completely with Georgia, with Crimea, with Ukraine. I think it is crystal clear to everybody that NATO and the Transatlantic Alliance is the crucial deterrent which keeps Europe safe. And I'm personally very grateful to the US for their continuous commitment to the security of Europe. And obviously, we are there to help and support you wherever we can. Now, I think we have found a way forward with the EU defense, which would, and this is certainly my preference, which would focus on the strong parts of EU, because remember, EU is not a military organization. It's a civilian organization. So I think EU is most capable to help in the issues where civil and military meld together. And let me mention a couple of them where I think our cooperation has a lot of perspective. First, military mobility. It's not a secret for those who work with these issues, but to move an echelon of heavy equipment from Germany to Estonia is an arduous task, bureaucratically, logistically. We can simplify that using the tools which EU has in its hand. I'm a bit worried because we have now gone into sort of, we have asked EU to do that, but in some ways we have also opened the door to a very kind of detailed, complicated approach to it. I hope that we could very quickly achieve some of the first results when it comes to military mobility. For instance, let's agree that all countries will give a pass or a right to cross their territory within 5 days. Now some countries have the limit of 40 days, in 5 days or less. Or let's agree that the document which one has to fulfill is standardized, similar to all countries, etc., etc. There are some things which can be done very, very quickly. Second, cyber. Again, there are civilian aspects to it, there are military aspects to it. That's why EU and NATO can work together on this field so well. I would advertise here NATO's Center of Excellence on Cyber Defense in Tallinn, because this is a body which doesn't belong neither to EU nor NATO, but to its founders. So all the political difficulties, which we all know are in the EU-NATO relationship, are not important there. We can use this as a platform. Why don't we have a joint crisis response manual for cyber incidents between EU and NATO? Let's try to use the Tallinn Center to work it out. And finally, exercises. Estonia organized the cyber defense exercise for defense ministers. The result of that exercise fed to the NATO CMX exercise. We can do a NATO CMX exercise which feds into EU exercises. If we cannot do it jointly, let's do them one after another. Let's be creative and let's try to create this common space where we can solve real life problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. Director, please.
Thank you. Well, I would start off by saying I have the privilege to have worked on both sides of town. And I think to talk about the debate which has been in the newspapers these days about competition between NATO and EU is something of the past. And I went back to the sacred texts, and I went back to the strategic concept of NATO in 1991, the first one after the end of the Cold War. And the language on a stronger European defense is very strong in that strategic concept. And if I go to the strategic concept of 2010, there is a sentence that says the EU is a strategic and unique partner for NATO. And there is a welcoming of the Treaty of Lisbon. And Treaty of Lisbon means PESCO. So we should really realize that we are trying to recast what has been agreed by our member states. Now, perceptions is another thing. I think at present there is a need to move on defense at European level because, as we all know, 3/4 of the EU citizens want the EU to do more in security and defense. It is a need from an industrial point of view. We cannot continue with the fragmentation of military requirements and we need to harmonize them. We see that the EU industry of defense has been diminishing over time, and capabilities without the defense industry to sustain them is not a complete capability. You're always a lame capability. But not only that, there is a call, and we see it in the US strategy starting in 2015, asking the Europeans to provide for their own security. So I think PESCO is a big step, an important step, and a welcome step for both EU and for NATO. The important thing is not that it brings in new ideas, but it needs to help us to get out old ideas. And with PESCO, the important thing is that we have to stop planning in purely national terms and start planning in a coherent manner in Europe so that we can have an interoperable, capable, deployable group of forces. And now I come to the issue of many times we discuss about the burden sharing in debate. I think that I'm not going to go into the issue of the investment percentage, but I think we should put more accent in two other aspects also. We should be thinking of maintaining a shared vision, which is as important as a level of investment. And secondly, we need to move from a partnership which is only operational and doctrinal into a partnership that includes technological and industrial matters. And this I've been saying for some time. I see now that there is concern that PESCO brings about industrial issues also. But PESCO can be developed in a way which is compatible with not being protectionist. The same as I have been saying in the last years, that it's very important that both sides of the Atlantic remain interoperable. And I have serious concerns with the big effort of the third offset strategy, which last year devoted more than $70 billion to technologies in the new domains, which might create a technological gap with us. And we have to be, as Europeans, ready to participate in this effort also. And I have made that point many times. So burden sharing, okay, but let's accompany it with a shared vision and a shared partnership in industrial and technological aspects. And then to come to the issue of detracting capabilities from what NATO needs. Well, I would only point out that in the European Defense Agency, working very closely with NATO, with all member states, we have been working on a very sensitive issue which the minister mentioned before, which is military mobility. NATO had been working on it for a few years. It's essential for common defense, but it's essential for our day-to-day life, for exercises. And what we have done is come up with a roadmap where we have actors, shortfalls, and timelines. And now it will be up to the responsibility of member states to take this forward, be it in the NATO forum or in EU. So we are working hand in hand in NATO. And it's a PESCO project also. So I don't see how does not match. The important thing is that all these initiatives have to be capability driven and that we ensure the coherence for those member states which are also in NATO, that they are not contradictory to what they are doing for NATO. So, and then finally, and I'm very happy to be on the same panel as the Norwegian minister. The role that Norway has in the agency today is among the seven more active countries in the agency, so well above the majority of member states. So I do not see any obstacle to a very close involvement in the activities we are carrying forward. And I hope that that will be the case. And we are doing that in many other domains, in single European skies and many others. So that, I would leave it there.
Gracias, Jorge. Senator.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm usually John McCain's sidekick, wingman, and John can't be here. And I've had so many people pass along their prayers and best wishes for Senator McCain. And I want to thank you on behalf of the McCain family. And we all miss him dearly. Jim, thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I'm one of 535 members of Congress, and I'll give you my view. I think it's shared by some anyway. Anything that can push back against this wave of nationalism throughout the world, I am for. Anything that makes Europe more engaged and integrated with NATO, I am for. I've always been reluctant to support a European Defense Force because I think it would take away from NATO. I don't believe that anymore. I believe that some of the things that you've laid out in terms of commonality in logistics and how the European Union on the civilian side could actually help the military capability in NATO makes sense to me, particularly in the cyber area where there's got to be an integration of the military-civilian response. But the main thing for me is I am appreciative of any effort that would make our European allies think as a group. Every country is proud of itself. Every state in America is proud of itself. But we're better together. And so if this initiative can create a more coherent voice, better deal with the common threats we face, our friends in Russia are challenging all democracies in the European Union and the United States and throughout the world. If we can coordinate our response on the cyber side better, speak with one voice with the Russians more effectively. From an American perspective, the more you can contribute to NATO, the easier it is for me to talk to President Trump. And I have been to Afghanistan and Iraq 42 times. I have seen NATO soldiers bleed for a war that started with an attack on America. I'll never forget that day when Article 5 was invoked on our behalf. So I am a big fan of NATO. I've always been leery of a European defense initiative until now. I think it actually may be the antidote to this nationalist fever. where we begin to think about our commonality and our threats, but how we deal with the threats and make NATO more effective. I don't think it takes away at all. But here's the question I have. Our friends in Britain feel like the European Union is not a good economic deal for them, but they feel like NATO is. And I'm hoping that maybe they will see a value to the European Defense Initiative that might get British friends back more integrated. So the idea that Britain sees the European Union as a bad economic deal, but NATO being a good deal for the British, maybe this can be a bridge, and maybe it can slow down some of the other countries who are thinking that the European Union is no longer a good deal for them. From my point of view, as an American who believes that democracies are under attack, the more alliances, the better between democratic countries. The more integration of capabilities, the better. I am glad to be with you.
Well said, sir. I'll applaud that. Let me just make one quick observation and then kind of throw out a couple of questions, and then again we'll open it up to a conference hall-wide conversation. The comment I want to make, just kind of picking up on something Senator Graham said, is that as the SACEUR for 4 years, and I see the current SACEUR here, Mike Scaparotti, great to see you, sir. I know he'd agree with this. We have seen NATO and the EU work alongside each other. We've seen them do that at sea in counter-piracy operations. We've seen them in Afghanistan. We've seen them in the Balkans. So we do have a kind of a model that we can use to make this work operationally. I want to stipulate that and also echo Senator Graham's comments, and I see so many uniformed admirals and generals here, about the bravery of our European colleagues, troops, and fellow soldiers and sailors and airmen. That's why this will work operationally. My countervailing comment or my cautionary note, Jorge, would be simply, yes, we're connected. Yes, we're capable. Yes, we operate together well. But I think we want to ensure we don't duplicate. And that, I think, is crucial because we are in an era of limited resources. And so as I look at a new command structure to park alongside an existing NATO command structure, I'd want to be careful as that kind of idea matures. So those would be a couple of operators' thoughts to throw out to the panel. If I may, Ambassador Gottmuller, let me first invite you to respond to anything you've heard. And then, secondly, could you say a word, given your expertise in arms control, about how do nuclear weapons fit into this? Is the EU going to take its nuclear side back, the Force de Frappe and the UK Tridents, or will that remain under General Scaparotti? How do you think that will play in this?
Well, I'll begin with the line from the Warsaw Summit statement, and that is related to as long as nuclear weapons exist, NATO will be a nuclear alliance. And again, Jens mentioned that in his remarks a while ago. So, but that means we have well-honed ways for dealing with nuclear weapons in the alliance. We have, obviously, dual-capable aircraft. We have now the B-61 warhead that is going through its life extension program. So we see the future with regard to our dual capable non-strategic missions in Europe. And that is an area where the Allies are working very hard now to think about the future in that regard. What does it mean? How are allies going to be working together in the future on that particular set of missions? In addition to which, of course, we have the strategic nuclear forces that are in the hands of the United States, the UK, and France, and they play their own particular role. Quite honestly, going forward, I don't see major changes in how we think about nuclear weapons in the alliance, be they strategic nuclear weapons or non-strategic tactical nuclear weapons. But what I would emphasize is the focus now in the alliance is raising, as we say, raising our nuclear IQ, because for many years nuclear weapons were more or less on the back burner, and allies didn't have to think about them, grapple with them, But frankly, in the way we see some of the exercise activity recently of the Russian Federation, there's been quite a bit of concern internationally, but there's been concern inside the NATO alliance. And really, it's gotten allies to really understand and embrace the fact that the nuclear IQ within the alliance has to be raised. That means thinking about how we train and exercise, thinking about how we discuss nuclear weapons at the NAC table. These are all issues that I think are very, very important. But I do want to emphasize the flip side of the message that NATO is a nuclear alliance. It also means that NATO stands for continued emphasis on arms reduction, arms control, non-proliferation, and that I like to stress that reductions in nuclear weapons are not at all contradicting the fact that you can have and you should have a strong nuclear deterrent, as other aspects of your deterrent need to be strong.
Thank you, Ambassador. Let me just now open it up for the panelists if they want to respond to anything they've heard from other panelists in initial commentary. And if not, we'll open it up. Let me just take a moment. Everybody ready to go with the audience? Here we go. So the first question by tradition is asked by one of the young Munich leaders who may or may not be moving to a microphone.
Hi, Johnny Mercer. I'm a Member of Parliament in the United Kingdom. And yes, we have voted to leave the European Union, but we're not leaving Europe. Europe's security is the United Kingdom's security, and our Prime Minister has time and again reiterated her commitment and our commitment to the unequivocal defence of Europe. But there is obviously some scepticism and concern around the formation of European defence. How are we going to make sure, and is the panel confident that there are not structures being put in place that would prohibit or make it harder for a third party to join in with that European Union defence? And secondly, look, the reality of this is that at the moment, the vast majority, and we heard it earlier from the head of NATO, the vast majority of European nations do not commit anywhere near 2% of GDP to NATO. So how can we really expect them to contribute effectively to a second alliance? And how are we going to work hard to make sure none of that duplication takes place?
So how do we avoid duplication, and how are we doing on 2%? So let me just go back this way, if I can, and ask Senator Graham to take a swing at those two pitches.
Well, it's the same wallet. You know, no matter what you call it, it comes out of the same wallet in each country. Right. And the idea of duplication is a concern. A lot of countries are getting toward 2%. Some are not there yet, and we hope they will, which makes it easy for a guy like me in the United States to say, NATO's a good deal, because I really, really believe it. But let me throw out an idea, and I just talked to General Mattis a few minutes ago. Transnational terrorism is a threat that we all face. As ISIL is diminished on the battlefield, the ones that we don't kill are moving around everywhere. And we're capturing them. We have about a 500, and it could well be into the thousands pretty quickly, the Syrian Democratic Forces are holding. They're not a nation state. There are a lot of ISIL members from Europe and all over the world, and we're trying to figure out what to do with these people. So maybe the European Defense Initiative could come up with a confinement facility or some idea of how, at least to the European component of this, you could create a facility to deal with a bunch of killers that if somebody doesn't deal with pretty soon, they're going to get out. And transnational terrorism, the best way to defeat it is through intelligence gathering. Most of the intelligence gathering is done by civilian organizations. So it'd be nice if you could have a civilian military component to the European Union that could share intelligence with the Five Eyes and NATO, to get your law enforcement officials in the EU working with military elements that could integrate NATO and the people who are in the path of terrorism. You see where I'm headed? I could just see unlimited application of how a European Union defense component could integrate civilian law enforcement to gather intelligence to deal with an enemy that's on the move. We have literally 500, soon be well over 1,000 prisoners in the hands of the Syrian Democratic Forces who are not a nation state. And the United States will take some, but we're not going to take all. So somebody needs to figure out what to do with these people, and most of them come from Europe. I didn't answer your question, but that's okay. I'm in Congress. I don't have to answer.
Jorge, you want to pick up on Senator Graham's very interesting initiative? I can see some antibodies emerging already, but the practicality of it is profound. Or do you want to go to the 2%?
I will go because it's more in my domain. This goes way beyond my purview. But if you allow me to come back to the issue of duplication in general, I would, if you allow me, and it's a big lack of prudence toward the previous Supreme Allied Commander to say that unnecessary duplication, because the military always like duplication where it's necessary. So we should not be overkilling on that. Now, outside the agency, and I understand you were referring to having some sort of command structure within the EU, which is not the business of the agency. But I would only ask a question to all the military commanders in this room. At present, the EU missions, the executive missions, report directly to the PSC, to the Permanent Security Committee. Right. Now, if I were a commander and I did not have a strategic commander and I had to report directly to the North Atlantic Council, you can imagine how difficult that would be to run a mission. So it is a purely practical issue, and I take it. And that doesn't mean that we are going to use the NATO command structure when it comes to common defense. That has been very clear. So I think there is a question. In some cases, you need some sort of line of command that goes from the purely tactical field level to the strategic level, political level. There is a void there.
Okay.
And if you want a strong European defense to do the job it has to do, for example, in missions in Africa, etc., it has to have some command element. Now, as far as duplication in general, I don't see that today.
Okay.
The majority of capability development programs which fill in those roadmaps that were agreed as critical shortfalls in Wales 4 years ago, I see the word or the flag EDA on them. So they're being done in the EU context. And one of them, Norway is participating, is the multinational air-to-air refueling fleet, which was born in EDA and will end up in the NSPA agency of NATO. So the same as we are doing that, we are doing it in other domains, in counter-improvising explosive devices, in many other aspects which are of the common benefit. So we are not detracting, as we're saying. And then finally, for the UK, and not setting up structures that will not allow the UK to contribute to the EU and to a strong European security and defense identity. At least with the agency, I think with the example I gave before of Norway, there's a long way to go within the existing channels. Now, what will happen? That will depend on the negotiation, which is a wider issue.
Indeed. Thank you. Mr. Minister?
Thank you. First, I'll tackle the Brexit issue. I think it's extremely important to keep in mind, as the British government has always reminded us, and I think it's absolutely true, that Great Britain, while leaving the European Union, is not leaving Europe. And the situation in Estonia is the best proof to it. There is a British framework battalion, 1,000 men, 150 kilometers from the Russian border, protecting NATO, Estonia, Europe, European values. I think it's a great testament to the fact how involved Great Britain is in our mutual security and defense cooperation. So I would hope, as a defense minister, I don't want to get bogged into details of Brexit. I know there are people in the room and here in the building who know much, much more about it than I do. But I would like these security and defense issues to be kept somewhat separate from the other aspects of our cooperation. I think it's natural that in trade there are a lot of nuances which can also get acrimonious. Let's not beat around the bush. But I would like to have security relationship negotiated from the basis of joint values. Obviously, there are certain legal issues, there are certain financial issues which have to be hammered out, but I think we should look at these issues with a fresh pair of eyes and with a very positive and constructive look. And I think, I really think it's doable. Now, when it comes to duplication of NATO and the EU, has been mentioned several times here. I mean, I don't want to get you into the deep or depth of defense planning, and again, there are people who know more about it than I do. But the fact is that the NATO defense planning and EU defense planning are not necessarily totally sort of from two different times or from two different ways. Because if you do NATO planning in the modern circumstances, you would focus more on what you might call heavy. If you do EU defense planning, then looking at what type of operations EU would operate in, you would go more on light or very light. So there is a theoretical possibility that these two processes will start to interfere with each other. That's why I think when we say there should be no duplication, the expert should make clear and should guarantee that there is actually no duplication, not only in sort of high political terms, but in actual sort of nuts and bolts terms, because there are certain risks here.
Thank you. Mr. Minister, anything to add there?
Thank you. Yeah, I was tempted to give the young leader some views on how to be a country outside the European Union, but you will see. I think this is an important question, and defense will be one of the arenas where we would have to cooperate. Well, I think science would be the next, where UK and EU and other countries would have to cooperate, because we need the knowledge and we need the knowledge to work together. For the question on duplication, I think we have a national command, and then I think for military operation we should use the NATO command. That's it. And I think to engage EU, yes, we could have a broader approach to different crises. And we got brilliant examples on what EU could participate in. So I think that's the job we had to do. NATO's role, EU's role, but a broad approach to any crisis. And I think that's the way we could go forward.
Thank you. And Ambassador, you want to kind of wrap up this question, well, which we will not duplicate by answering again.
Okay, that's fine. I just wanted to pick up on Senator Graham's point about NATO and EU cooperation on counterterrorism. It's actually an area that NATO and the EU are putting already a tremendous amount of emphasis on. We've done a lot of work over the last year in setting out a list of priorities, and counterterrorism is front and center. So one of the interesting things, and Senator Graham pointed this interesting, you know, there's this kind of difference in what the responsibilities of the two organizations are. Obviously, EU has the inherent link to domestic law enforcement, protection of borders, these types of issues. And for NATO, you know, it's a somewhat different set of responsibilities, so to say. But how do you bring the two organizations together so that they can serve the priority of the fight against terrorism together? And I think there are some important ways that are already emerging. For example, in the sharing, we're looking at sharing of biometric data for the use of law enforcement, and biometric data that has emerged from field operations. So I think these are some very practical kinds of projects we are going to be working on in the coming months, and you'll see as we run up to the July we have a June ministerial again for the defense ministers, but the July summit, that this whole story about how we can together work counterterrorism will be front and center.
Thank you. So I have a question from the audience from a member of the Ukrainian parliament who says, do you believe Ukraine will ever join NATO, or will Russia do everything it can to prevent this? I should mention that we will be privileged to have President Poroshenko make a final comment upon conclusion of this panel, but this will set him up very nicely, one way or the other.
Well, maybe I'll start with that one. That's an obvious one for me, I suppose, at least to begin with. But this is the 10th anniversary this year of the Bucharest summit, at which four countries were essentially put on, we call it a list of countries who are interested in joining NATO and whom NATO would welcome. Georgia and Ukraine, as well as the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and also Bosnia and Herzegovina. So that's the 10th anniversary this year. We are, as always, thinking about our open door. NATO has an open door policy. I will note that of all of those four countries, we have four countries who all have an interest in NATO, but one, and that is Ukraine, has not officially stated as a matter of national policy that it is seeking a membership action plan, and that's the step you take as a country to begin on the road toward NATO membership.
Mm-hmm. Let me open the question up to any of the other panelists, Minister and then Senator.
I very much believe that Ukraine will be in NATO. Obviously, I cannot predict the time, but I have always said to my Ukrainian and Georgian colleagues that be patient, work for it, be ready. If there is an opportunity, you have to use it. I mean, you have to be ready to use it. Take, for instance, the Baltic states. It wasn't a given that the Baltic states will be members of NATO. I mean, at some point it would have sounded absurd, even in a scientific conference. What happened was, for a minuscule year, President Bush and President Putin were almost buddies. I mean, they looked at each other's soul. You remember the story. The important thing here is that when we joined, President Putin said only one thing. He said, well, we don't like it, but we certainly won't start a war for it, against it. So times are very different, obviously. And the other point was that we had President Bush as a figure in US politics who was so focused on values that when he was presented with the option of taking the Baltic states, he, based on his own views and values, had no problem in saying, yeah, let's take them. So this was a moment, this was a window. And if you are ready, this window will open itself. I understand that the Ukrainian and Georgian situation at the moment is very different because of the military aggression, but as a general point, you should never lose hope.
Senator?
Yeah, I know this is a difficult question, but I'd just like to reinforce what you're saying. To our friends in the Ukraine, I want it to be your decision, not Russia's decision. To our friends in Georgia, I want it to be your decision, not the United States' decision. And to Russia, you may feel a bit under siege here, but you got to ask yourself, how does this movie end? The Ukrainians gave up a nuclear weapon arsenal with the understanding that if I do this, I'm good to go, and we signed up and everybody else did, and our friends in Russia stepped all over that. So the rule of law means nothing to the Russians. Now, does it mean anything to us? So I'd like to have a better relationship with Russia, but it's very difficult right now. Yesterday, in my country, the entire intelligence community, the Trump people, said Russia is interfering in our election for 2018. So, I used to worry a lot about antagonizing Russia. I don't worry about that anymore. You're going to get what you deserve if you keep this up. So to our friends in Ukraine and Georgia and everywhere else, be patient. Hopefully the rest of us will get a little bit of a backbone and push back against aggression that I think is just simply unwarranted.
And now we will open it up to the audience for further questions. We have some microphones available. Sir.
Carl Kaiser, Harvard University. I have a question to Rose Cottermiller. During the Cold War, there were various agreements on conventional forces between East and West, MBFR, mm-hmm. the Conventional Forces Agreement. My question to you is there any chance to go back to that effort to deal with some of the problems that we have now?
Well, I think we already have some raw material well in place, and there are treaties in the conventional realm that continue to operate. Of course, the Russians walked away from implementing the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty in 2007, and so that is an issue. But the superstructure of the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty is still in place. It still provides for security in places like the South Caucasus that have been of concern between Armenia and Azerbaijan, for example. They are conducting inspections on each other's territory, so it continues to play a security role, not the security role that it could play if it were being fully implemented. Now, there are other mechanisms in place. There is the Open Skies Treaty, also providing for transparency. And finally, the Vienna document, which is a whole realm of transparency and confidence-building measures. Again, I have concern, NATO has concerns, and I think many countries who are have signed up to the Vienna document are concerned that the Russians are not fully implementing it. It is a political commitment, not a legally binding treaty. But the point I want to make is we have the superstructure still in place. The raw material is still in place to have conventional confidence building and transparency in Europe, as well as maintenance of certain levels. But I do want to say here that the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty, we have long ago, you know, basically dispelled those limitations with the end of the Warsaw Pact and what has happened in the years since. So I think it is worthwhile to think about the future of conventional arms control in Europe. There is a structured dialogue that the German Ministry of Foreign Affairs has been organizing. It's carried out under the umbrella of the OSCE. I would just caution us all, though, to think about what we have available right now that we should be making better use of, and we should be concerned about making better use of. And we have to bear in mind that we need also to raise confidence in the process itself. If there have been years and years going on where these regimes have not been properly implemented, where there have been compliance problems and concerns, and in some cases violations, you know, is it the right moment to engage in further discussion of this matter? I do welcome the structured dialogue, though, because it is helping us think together about what the threats are out there. It's helping us talk together about doctrine and strategy and the differences and what kinds of, perhaps, problems may ensue from that, lack of understanding. Very valuable to have that structured dialogue going on. But I think we also must bear in mind that whatever we do in the future on conventional arms must be built on this solid baseline that we already have available, and must also bear in mind that we really need to be confident in what's going to happen both at the negotiating table and afterwards in the implementation process. If we are afraid that implementation would not take place, why even bother?
Can I very quickly?
Of course.
I have a feeling that we sometimes misread Russians when it comes to arms control, especially at the present time. We are all used to think that arms control is a good thing. And when we go to Moscow with an arms control proposal, it's a good thing. We are doing something positive. I have a feeling that from the Russian point of view, Russia, which is very interested in propping up its defense structure quickly and forcefully and in big volumes, they see it more as a trick. You know, we bring them a piece of paper and try with this paper to limit their right to rebuild their armed forces. So what we see as a positive move, they would often see as a negative move. At least that's my understanding of the situation. But
others? While we're waiting, I'd like to ask a geographic question of the panel, and it's about the Arctic and the high north. And Mr. Minister, I'll start with you, if I may. If we look at the Arctic and the nations that surround the Arctic Sea, it's United States, Canada, Norway, Denmark via Greenland, Sweden, Finland. These are the members of the Arctic Council along with Iceland. Some are NATO members, some are EU members. Russia, obviously, not a member of either. How does the panel kind of view the Arctic as a geographic region as we think of this, where we see EU, NATO, and Russia in an area of the world where, here's a news flash, the ice is melting? We can have an argument about global warming and the causes, I guess, but as a mariner, I'll tell you the ice is melting. It's going to open up geopolitical competition. Say a word, if you would, Mr. Minister, about the Arctic and this organization.
Yeah. We see the Arctic as an area of low tension still. That's why we try to communicate on a lot of levels and a lot of we have a military discussion with Russia. They are aggressive in Ukraine. We have our hotline from our headquarters to the North Fleet to avoid misunderstandings. But in the same time, in the Arctic Council, we discuss everything else. And we have good discussions in the Arctic Council, because we can discuss science, we can discuss geographical agreements.
Search and rescue.
Search and rescue, yeah. We also have, in the North, Norway and Russia are cooperating very well on managing the fish stocks.
Yeah, great.
Which is important and very successful. So we try to talk to Russia on a lot of to keep a lot of channels, because it's important. We think for we are geographically we are located in their strategic area.
Exactly.
So And they are a nuclear power. So we don't reckon Russia a military threat to Norway today. But something could happen elsewhere in the world, which will make Russia act for them in a defensive way, and which for us will be in an offensive or aggressive way. So we're trying to keep the contact. And the Arctic Council, I found it really useful and really important.
I agree.
Because you could take the military and the defense out of the room and discuss other things. And then the Arctic will be of highly value, because when the ice is melting, the value of the fish, minerals, energy, and a lot of work agree on borders and that stuff. So yeah, it's coming. But for now, we reckon it's an area of low tension, really low tension.
Question from the audience. How important is it that Great Britain fully participates in EU defense even after Brexit? How far should the EU go to make it possible? Jorge, can I start with you on that one?
Well, here you bring into a very dangerous area where I can lose a step, but I would say that...
No one is listening. It's okay.
It's a completely crystal ball at present. I can say several things which have been clearly stated both by the UK government and the industry, that they want to remain as far as possible near to the EU efforts on defence. And we see it now, for example, in the building of PESCO. They have a big interest of the rules of governance being established, once the rules of governance of the projects and PESCO are established. And the same thing goes for the participation in projects related to research or to capability development with the agency. There they want to have a relationship with the agency, and they have stated that very clearly. If you look at the five priorities that the Industry Association of the UK has given the government as homework, one of them is in the future to establish an administrative arrangement with EDA. So how that will be built, we will probably have to see it in the political declaration that they will have to negotiate with member states now.
Fair. Senator.
I think this would probably be a good test as to what value this European defense component brings. If the British say, and the European Union as an economic entity is not good for us, NATO is, and if they see the European Defense Initiative more like NATO, then I think you have done your job. I think the canary in the coal mine as to how well you do your job is to whether or not our friends in Britain would feel like it's good for them to invest. And as to the Arctic, I don't know anything about it other than it's coal. And that'd be a good place to send these prisoners from Syria.
Any other comments on anything we've discussed, Mr. Minister?
I think I said it earlier, and I think we had to treat the countries from EU and NATO equal in this the topic. And I think it's difficult to argue otherwise, because without being protectionistic, and I don't think we should build barriers when we're talking defense and development of this.
Let me open it up for one last question right here. This woman in the white sweater.
Ulrike Franke from the European Council on Foreign Relations. I'd like to hear your view on a proposal by Emmanuel Macron, namely this idea of founding a European DARPA to develop technology, military technology in Europe. Is that something, in your view, that makes sense? And if it does, how could that look like?
Well, again, maybe I'll start on that, because I am a great admirer of DARPA. And for those of you who don't know that acronym, it's the Defense Advanced Research Project Office in the Department of Defense. It's existed for many years. And, well, as some say, that's the organization from which the Internet sprang in the first case, or from one of its predecessor organizations. So I think it has played really an amazing role in the U.S. system in terms of driving thinking about new technologies and driving thinking and into implementation. And so it has been a very, very important entity in the United States. Frankly, I don't know enough about the structures of science and science organization here in Europe to say whether there's anything that matches that now on the European scene. But I would say that there is an abiding worry now, I think, among all in NATO and among all the member states of both NATO and the European Union, that we are seeing new technology rapidly advancing in areas like artificial intelligence. We've been talking a lot today about cyber. That's only one area. But there are many new frontiers of technology now that I think we all feel that we have to keep a sharp eye on. We have to try to understand the implications. We have to understand how they could emerge into the defense sphere, either as threats, as weapons in the hands of our enemies, or as perhaps useful military technology going forward. So I think in general it's a good idea, but I base that comment on my admiration for the history and for really the benefits that the Defense Advanced Research Projects Office has had for the United States.
Yeah, I think that's well said, and I'll add, if I could, that one of the emerging areas in which the European scientific community is extremely capable is in biology, biotech, fighting pandemics, using various elements of biotechnology. I think that has applications both for good and for ill in the defense sector as well. I think we had a question right back here, this gentleman. Yes.
Thank you, Andrew Mikta, the Marshall Center. I'd like to come back to the money question. And Senator Graham said that ultimately it all comes out from the same budget. We had the Wales Summit where we committed to 2%. We had Warsaw. I suspect in Brussels we'll also have a 2% affirmation. We recognize when we talk about the threats that the environment has deteriorated considerably. And yet it is so hard to actually get the allies to that level of commitment when it comes to the bottom line, which is money. Without discounting everything that's been achieved, are we not actually failing to move fast enough? What is the opinion of the panel to actually address the threat that is in front of us, precisely in terms that you, Senator, mentioned, money, commitment? Thank you.
Well, I just want to say this. I've been skeptical of the European Defense Force would duplicate NATO. It'd be money that really doesn't add capability, and it'd be more of a political exercise than it would be adding military value. My opinion's changed. I think the biggest benefit from this exercise is it's Europe acting together again. Anything that will stop this wave of nationalism. Now, I'm a proud American, and I'm sure you're proud of your country, but we're literally all in this together. The people who want to kill you want to kill me. So I do believe it can add capability to NATO. I want you to get to 2% so Trump will be quiet. But you should be at 2%. And I know that some things are not counted that probably should be counted. It's not just a monetary number that I'm trying to achieve. It's an attitude. I'm trying to restore an attitude that served mankind well. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, we're sort of adrift. What relevancy does NATO have? You know, why do this anymore? Then along comes 9/11, and you came to our aid. So to the extent that you can meet your 2% obligation under NATO, please. To the extent that you're going to create capability outside NATO that would make NATO more effective, that could take civilian and military components to make them work together, actually, I encourage you to do it, and it's money well spent. And if you have to pick between the two, I would say put some money on the European Defense Initiative, because the reason I'm so excited about this, it gets you back in the game of being together, not separate.
Others would like to come in on this? Please, Jorge.
Yes, I could not agree more with you, Senator. And there's one piece of data which shows that when budgets went down and there was less money being devoted to defense in Europe, we spent less together. Cooperative programs were half in those years. In 8 years, it went down by half, by 50%. Now that defense budgets are climbing, we should not make the big mistake of spending inefficiently. The second thing is research in the defense domain is key, because it is not worth developing an investment on capabilities which are on the market now but will not get us to do the job with the challenges we have ahead. And that requires investing now, and that is low. So again, there is a qualitative aspect that we should not forget when this surge in investment happens. And the third thing I would say is that not all member states have the capability to manage this increase of defense budget. This is a problem. This is a problem because they don't have big procurement agencies, so we should not try and put one size fits all for this issue, because it doesn't work.
Minister.
It is clear that 2% has a strong symbolic meaning. It's a political statement. It's also of practical need. But I very much agree that we should spend it as effectively as possible. And there are really many challenges to it. Let me just bring up one, which is the arms industry. I mean, the money goes up now, the prices go up. There is no real competition in a way how the arms industry is structured. The older equipment, which was in the market, is now almost gone. For instance, years and years you could have bought a used tank relatively cheap. Now it's all in use. People have stopped sort of scrapping tanks. It's all back in use. So there is a real challenge how we could beat that process in being more effective with the tools we have been discussing here. Work jointly, work more effectively. But the fact is, every nation has its own arms industry. A politician cannot go home and say, look guys, we discussed in Brussels, it would be great to have only one APC, one type of APC, so we'll close this great factory here. It's impossible. So I think with this effectiveness, we are facing a number of structural problems, structural issues, which need further discussion.
Others on this point, Minister and then Ambassador.
I just briefly add that I think the 2% is an important wake-up call. And it was a really good meeting. It was a wake-up call, and many are struggling. And I agree, if this could get us Europeans to cooperate better together, to improve better, that's good. And as I read the discussion, we need to reach that 2% goal. So.
Ambassador.
Two very quick points. I always like to remind people that 2% is not an unattainable goal. As recently as 2000, every single NATO ally was spending 2% of their budgets on defense. So gross domestic product on defense. I've got to get my statistics right here. So 2000, it wasn't that long ago. We've been through a lot since then, obviously, with a profound economic crisis in the period between 2008 and 2011, but GDPs are coming back now. So we need to look hard and dig deep, in my view, inside the NATO alliance on this. And we are moving in the right direction. direction. There's no question about it, but there is more work that has to be done. And that was a clear message out of our defense ministerial this week. The other point, and I hope it will ring alarm bells in European capitals, is once the UK leaves the EU, 80% of defense budget for, you know, NATO will be outside of the European Union. So UK, Canada, Norway, etc., and of course the United States. So it's really going to be important, I think, for the European capitals to pay attention to that wake-up call and realize that more needs to be done on the defense budget story.
Wonderful comments from the panel. I'll just underline with a quote from the first Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, General Eisenhower. As the alliance was being formed, he said, "The greatest global strategic advantage of the United States is a unified, peaceful Europe." What a great point. We're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined by President Poroshenko, who will make a kind of closing comment, a chapeau, if you will, for this session. Please join me in a wonderful round of applause for these great panelists. It's been a great job. Thank you.